Hi, I'm Susan Glasser, and welcome back to the Global Politico.
These are bad actors, and we're going to need to stand up to them because the only thing the Russians respect is strength. They don't see that in this president. They see weakness. And they also see in this president someone they can manipulate just by saying flattering things. And that's a real danger to this country, and it's a danger to our allies, and we need to step up to this challenge.
Hi, this is Susan Glasser, and welcome back to the Global Politico. Our guest this week is Congressman Adam Schiff, top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee. Just days ago, Republicans abruptly shut down the committee's year-long investigation of President Trump and the 2016 Russian election meddling, to the surprise of Schiff and the Democrats on the panel. Now, even many Republicans are pointing fingers, and we'll hear from Congressman Schiff about how it all went down, what it's like when a congressional committee melts down, and what he thinks comes next in the investigation of the president that is still ongoing. Congressman Schiff, I should note, was one of our very first guests on the Global Politico a year ago, at the very start of that investigation on the House Intelligence Committee. So it seemed only appropriate to have him back as our very first repeat guest to tell us what happened. Back then, we started our conversation by saying it had been a very topsy-turvy week in the brand new Trump White House. That was the week that National Security Advisor Michael Flynn had been fired. Well, the same could be said of this past week, too. A topsy-turvy week when everyone wondered who would be the next to leave the Trump White House. Congressman, welcome back.
It's certainly been a topsy-turvy week again, hasn't it?
It has, and we may be meeting on the eve of another National Security Advisor being pushed out the door. That's at least the speculation at the moment. And I understand that John Bolton is one of the potential candidates. And the pressing question here is, does that mean that the president has gotten a commitment that he'll shave the mustache? Because I understand that was an impediment to begin with.
Well, if this is a reality show, we know that this is a president for whom appearances matter. So I'm not sure if the contestants are being judged on that. But then again, maybe President Trump has learned. He thought that Rex Tillerson fit the suit, right? You know, that he appearances seemed to matter in the selection of that, but then he soured on him. So
that's true. That's true. And it'll be interesting to see whether if Pompeo is confirmed for that position, his proximity to the president and the favor that he holds with the president will allow him, or if he will even seek to restore the ranks of the State Department, which have been so badly depleted under Rex Tillerson. We can only hope so. In many respects, I think that role as a policy maker is a better fit for Mike Pompeo. But I hope that it will mean that the State Department will now get the attention and the resources that it really needs.
Before we jump back to the investigation, former Congressman Pompeo obviously has a wide network here on the Hill, and you dealt with him also in your capacity on the Intelligence Committee. You're one of the eight members of Congress who, you know, receive briefings on classified information and, you know, sort of key part of the leadership. What was your impression of him as the CIA director? And, you know, he seemed to somewhat soothe that workforce at a time when President Trump had assaulted them and their integrity.
Well, I think that the his tenure at the CIA was one that the employees and career servants at the CIA welcomed. They wanted someone who would not be out of favor with the president and subject the agency to further attacks by the president. I think he was a good manager of people. We've had some very serious policy differences, both when he was in Congress and in the CIA. And I've had some concerns at times about his willingness to stand up to the president. There were a couple times where he diminished the significance of the Russian intervention in our election, and perhaps
publicly
even
or privately?
Publicly. Mm-hmm. And even more seriously, made the statement, which was a repeat of the president's talking points, but clearly untrue, that the intelligence community had found that the Russian intervention in our election had not affected the outcome. Now, clearly, that's not at all what the intelligence community found. And they made it quite explicit in their unclassified assessment. They were reaching no conclusion about that. That was beyond their purview. So when I would hear him repeat talking points or do the president's bidding that way in public, it certainly made me question whether he was willing to stand up to him in private.
Have you had any personal interaction with him as CIA director?
Certainly. Frequent interaction. And, you know, on many things we've had a real meeting of the minds, and other times we've had very, very serious differences.
Mm-hmm. Would you say those largely revolve around Russia or other matters?
I can't get into specifics, but they're more of a policy nature than they are of a allocation of resources or whether we're developing the right skill sets at the agency.
You don't think he was tilting intelligence, do you?
No, I don't. I don't think I've seen any evidence that he was trying to skew the intelligence we were seeing. I hope that he will continue to try to shed some of the partisanship that he exhibited in Congress. I don't think that his positions on Iran as a member of Congress were in the national interest, and it does concern me that those positions he had then are all too much in alignment with the president's positions now. Certainly that would be true if John Bolton became National Security Advisor. I don't see any of the critics of the Iran agreement offering a better solution. And if they take us out of this agreement, and we have another deadline coming up, then
that's in May,
we end up isolated, not Iran. And Iran may be back on the path to its nuclear program, but free from the sanctions, at least vis-a-vis the rest of the world. And that would, to my point of view, be the worst of all outcomes.
Well, you make the point about the intelligence and Russia and your concern about the representations of it. My guess is that concern is magnified by many times over when it comes to your colleagues on the House Intelligence Committee, the Republicans, who've now abruptly put an end to your investigation. It seems like the most controversial aspect of that, it's not really a surprise on some level that they were skeptics going into this case. They've resisted you every step of the way, but they seem to have gotten a lot of pushback in coming out and on a week when there's this nerve gas attack in the UK, when actually even President Trump's administration has put out sanctions that on Russia addressing the 2016 elections. Their conclusion seems really at odds with the facts to say that the Russians were not intervening on behalf of Donald Trump. Was this a misfire? I think the headline today in Politico is, what does it say? It says, Republicans fear they botched Russia report rollout is the headline today. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that. In many ways, they announced their conclusions, which included, among other things, that the Russians had not intervened in the election to help Donald Trump. Now, that's at odds with what the intelligence community has found. It's at odds with what our committee has found. It's at odds with what the Senate committee has found. It's odds with what Bob Mueller has found. It's a political statement, not a finding. And I think when they were forced to defend it, even within the last 24 to 48 hours, they couldn't. They acknowledged, well, clearly, you know, these ads and these other things that are already in the public domain show that they were attacking Hillary. Doesn't that help Donald Trump? And they had no answer. And it demonstrates, I think, the problem that we've had behind closed doors, which is they've been fundamentally unserious about this investigation. And tragically, that started from a very early point. We started out committed to a bipartisan, nonpartisan investigation and a unified report at the end of it. But within days of the open hearing we had with James Comey when he revealed the Trump campaign had been under a counterintelligence investigation, we had that midnight run by our chairman in which he went to some undisclosed location and then went to the White House the following day and announced that he had received from a secret source documents he had to show the White House, which he wouldn't show even his own committee, only to learn that he'd got these documents from the White House. It was a charade. From that point on, the mission of the chairman was protecting the White House, protecting the president. And so here we are, the Republicans say they're shutting down, they're not going to do anymore. The Senate isn't shutting down. They recognize the importance of this. Bob Mueller certainly isn't shutting down. Reports within the last 24 hours of subpoenas going out to the Trump Organization. And just within the last week, we have seen now reports of witnesses contradicting the sworn testimony of people who came before our committee, like Eric Prince and Roger Stone. And Republican members of our committee have just said they don't care. They'd really rather not know.
Tell me a little bit. I mean, I want, there's so much to unpack here, but how did this happen? I mean, they didn't even tell you, is that right, that they were just going to end the investigation?
That's right. That's right. And we would hear through, you know, sort of the rumor mill that, and sometimes they would state publicly that they were under enormous pressure to shut it down. Certainly the White House wanted it shut down. Certainly Breitbart wanted it shut down, and the Sean Hannitys and the Fox echo chamber wanted it shut down. And they buckled. And it was just a question of how soon they were going to buckle.
Do you have any intelligence on how explicit the collusion was with the White House?
I don't know, but we did ask the chairman when they put out that very partisan, misleading Nunes memo.
Right. This was the headline news 24 hours a day 6 weeks ago, and now is basically forgotten.
Yes, and it should be forgotten, except for the fact that it was a terrible chapter for our committee in which the chairman decided, with the acquiescence of his members, to cherry-pick intelligence and use a never-before-used House rule to publish that in a way that was misleading and omitted key facts to attack the FBI and to attack the department and try to undermine Bob Mueller. And that will chill the willingness of the intelligence community to share information with our committee, to see it abused by our chairman that way. So we asked the chairman, was this concocted with the White House the way that Midnight Run was? Is this a sequel to the Midnight Run? And he refused to answer the question for days. And when he finally did answer the question, he read a very lawyerly statement of about one sentence that said the White House was not involved in its drafting. But of course, that leaves open a whole lot of other coordination of that whole chapter. So it's a terrible tragedy, I think, for the public, because it means that, at least as far as the House is concerned, the public isn't going to get an accounting of what the Russians did and what the Trump campaign did, that too much of that work will be left to Bob Mueller. And this was not only the only authorized Russia investigation in the House, it was really the only authorized investigation, period. The House is doing no oversight of this administration. Countless violations of the Emoluments Clause and other elements of potentially corrupt behavior out of the White House, doing business deals out of the White House, are going uninvestigated and won't be, I think, as long as this crowd is in the majority.
So, okay, so a week ago, last Friday, did you know that on Monday they were going to shut down the investigation?
No.
Okay.
No.
And so...
And you know, similarly, when they produced that Nunes memo,
right?
We found out about it when they... announced it at our business meeting,
uh-huh,
and asked us to vote it out. They gave us about a minute or two to read it. I made a motion that we allow the members of the committee to actually read the underlying documents.
If you are chairman next year, will you make a pledge not to do that to the Republican minority if you get into the majority?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And indeed, up until this Russia chapter, really up until the Midnight Run, we had worked in a very bipartisan way. And in fact, even now, even through the worst of it, on our non-Russia business, we continue to work in a bipartisan way. But yes, this is no way to conduct an investigation. It's certainly not the way I would do it. And I think, frankly, had Mr. Conaway and I been really given the latitude to run the investigation, it would have been a very different investigation.
So you don't think this was really Congressman Conaway? You think this was Nunes who was really working with the White House?
Well, Chairman Nunes, even when he said he was stepping aside after the Midnight Run, never did, and continued to make all the key decisions, which witnesses would come in, when they would come in, what open hearings we'd have, what open hearings we wouldn't have, what subpoenas would go out, what subpoenas wouldn't go out, all of these sideshow investigations of FISA abuse and Uranium One and all of that, those were all decisions made by Chairman Nunes, not by Mike Conaway.
Do you believe Speaker Ryan was involved in that as well?
Of course. This was of such importance in the House and to the country. And the problems that we've had with our chair were raised with the Speaker. And the Speaker made the decision to be complicit in all this and to acquiesce in all of this. there's no hiding responsibility for the Republican leadership. I think one of the really sad realizations over the last year is not what kind of a president Donald Trump turned out to be. I think it was all too predictable, but rather how many members of Congress would be unwilling to stand up to him, and more than that, would be completely willing to carry water for him. That is a very sad realization.
So you didn't expect that?
I did not expect that. I thought there would be more Jeff Flakes, more John McCain's, more Bob Corker's, people who would defend our system of checks and balances, would speak out for decency, who would defend the First Amendment. When the president suggested pulling the license of NBC because he didn't like what they had to say, the speaker was asked about this, and his comment was, "I'm a conservative constitutionalist, and I support the First Amendment, and that's all I have to say." That's not much of a defense of our First Amendment rights. I take it by conservative constitutionalist, what he meant was he's conservative in his support for the Constitution when it's not convenient. Those kind of things, the willingness to see the president attack the independence of the Justice Department, attack the judiciary and judges that rule against the president as being illegitimate, to stand silent in the face of that is a real abdication of responsibility.
So going forward, what do you see happening to the Russia investigation? Let's talk first about your conclusions. Had you known now what you know a year ago, would you have been shocked? I mean, there's really a lot more information on the record. I was struck by that looking back at our first interview.
Oh, I would have been completely shocked. And I gave a very lengthy opening statement in that first hearing we had with James Comey, where I tried to set out what was alleged at the time and what was warranted in terms of investigation. We knew nothing at that time that we would later find out. If I were giving that opening statement now, I would be saying that we have evidence that in April of 2016, before even the Clinton campaign knew, the Russians approached the Trump campaign through a foreign policy advisor named George Papadopoulos and told him that they had stolen Clinton emails, that they wanted a relationship with the campaign, that they preview the dissemination of these stolen emails, that weeks later they would approach the highest levels of the campaign, that they would dispatch an attorney from Moscow with the promise of dirt on Hillary Clinton to a secret meeting in the Trump Tower, something they described as part of the Russian government's effort to help the Trump campaign.
In writing.
And that the campaign's response to this Russian overture, this invitation to collusion, was, "We would love it." And that the National Security Advisor would have secret conversations with the Russian ambassador designed to undermine the bipartisan policy of the United States to sanction Russia over its interference in our election and then lie about it. If I had suggested any of these things at the time, people would have said that you're smoking something. You'll never find evidence of that. And certainly nobody would ever put that in writing. But yet, of course, we found evidence of all of that and more. And so we've come a long way, but there's still a great many unanswered questions.
Right. And you released your Democrats on House Intelligence released a 21-page essentially roadmap to further lines of inquiry, things that you were pursuing at the time the investigation was shut down. Is it your view that there's an overall question mark on this evidence? You've been publicly quoted as saying there already is ample evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians. Do you believe there is already sufficient basis to proceed either with further indictment or with an impeachment case?
Well, there certainly is ample evidence of impeachment. Ample evidence of collusion, and the facts that I've just set out are clear evidence of collusion. Now, whether they and other facts known to us and known to the special counsel amount to proof beyond a reasonable doubt of a criminal conspiracy to violate a particular election code section, that will be something Bob Mueller will have to decide. And he still knows a great deal more than we do. For example, what did George Papadopoulos tell the rest of the campaign? Who was knowing in the campaign of what the Russian overture, the early overture, had been? Did that color the willingness of the president's son to take that meeting at Trump Tower? Why was the campaign manager and the president's son-in-law there? Why have three of the most senior campaign people in that meeting at a time when they're still fighting a contested convention about whether they'll be the nominee? They clearly thought this was a key meeting. Why were they so disappointed in what they got at the meeting? Were they expecting something different? All these questions need answers, and the majority doesn't want to know. What about these communications between Roger Stone and efforts by Cambridge Analytica to get stolen information from Julian Assange?
Do you expect there will be, as an informed observer only, indictments related to the hacking part of it? We haven't seen that yet.
Yes, and that's a very good question. I fully expect that there will be. The only question is whether the indictment on the hacking and dumping of documents operation is Russian only or includes Americans. When I saw the indictment, the Mueller returned, the grand jury returned, charging the 13 Russians with that ambitious social media campaign that surreptitious.
Right. This is the Internet Research Agency, St. Petersburg troll farm, basically.
Exactly. You know, there were two things that leapt out at me. First was the extraordinary level of detail that was included. You put that much detail about a Russian operation and you're potentially risking sources and methods, and the intelligence community must have signed off on that, which to me means that they felt that informing the public of this was sufficiently important to take that risk, and I think it's the right call. But the other thing that leapt out at me was there's no mention of the hacking and dumping operation. Now, why is that? It's certainly not because the evidence wasn't there. Indeed, the evidence of that was more fully developed earlier than the evidence of the social media campaign. The reason why you wouldn't include that, you know, speaking as a former prosecutor, when it reinforces the conspiracy allegations against the Russians, the reason you wouldn't include that is either that component involves Americans or you're not finished investigating whether Americans should be included in that part of the indictment.
And, of course, that's the part of the investigation that could lead more directly to this question of whether the Trump campaign actually was involved or knew about or colluded with the release of those hacked emails.
Yes. What Mueller charged in that indictment, the one that was released some weeks ago, was a conspiracy to defraud the United States. That is a good blueprint for how the hacking and dumping operation might be described, along with other elements involving the violation of U.S. election laws. But defrauding the American people, defrauding the U.S. government, defrauding the agencies that administer our election laws, that's the kind of conspiracy you would charge. That's what collusion would look like in legal terms. And the fact that that part of the Russian operation wasn't included tells me that he either has more work to do on the U.S. Person part of it, or that the U.S. persons will be included in that. But that indictment is coming. The only question is whether it includes U.S. persons or not.
Mm-hmm. So I found your document a very interesting reading that suggests a lot of names and entities for possible further investigation that was shut down. The Daily Beast today, I think, said the Republican report, it was like a half-written term paper. Well, you've offered us sort of a list of what could have been in the other part of the term paper. There's a lot to digest in there. What are two or three of what you thought were the most promising leads?
Well, you know, there's a lot more work to do on fleshing out what we already know about the social media campaign of the Russians, about the hacking and dumping operation of the Russians. You know, most of the areas, frankly, though, where the Republicans shut us down were on the issues of collusion and obstruction of justice. So we would have witnesses come before the committee who would invoke very broad privileges or even invoke no privilege and just say they didn't want to answer the questions. So Steve Bannon comes in. He's a perfect illustration. Really, the Bannon situation is a perfect illustration of all the problems with how the GOP conducted this investigation. You could look in microcosm.
Right. And this was right after he was fired, right?
Yes, not long after he was fired. But in microcosm, you can see in the Steve Bannon saga all of the problems with how the Republicans ran their investigation. So first, Bannon comes in as a voluntary witness, which is how we initially bring everyone in. He refuses to answer any question dealing with his time in the White House, his time on the transition, and most of his time even after he left the White House. He invokes no privilege. He simply says, I'm instructed by the White House not to answer. Now, the Republicans, unlike other witnesses who refused to answer, expressed great umbrage at this. This is unheard of. You can't do this. If we allow you to stonewall this way, then what will it do to our investigation and future investigations? They hand him a subpoena on the spot. Now, this was extraordinary because other witnesses who stonewalled, and we said they need a subpoena, the majority said no. Now, why do they treat him differently? Because Steve Bannon was a man without a country, neither beloved in the White House nor beloved at Breitbart. So they give him a subpoena. He comes back now under compulsion of the subpoena, and he's got 25 questions written out for him helpfully by the White House, which are the only questions he will answer. And the answer to each one of them is no. So one of the questions might be, did you meet with so-and-so? And the answer, he tells us, is no. Now, that would give you the impression that he had no communication with that person. So I would ask, did you speak with that person? And the answer was yes. And what did you say? I am not answering that question.
So he was making a distinction between meeting and speaking.
Yes. Well, and I'm sure the White House didn't even want him to acknowledge that he was had even spoken to the person. But the whole goal of the White House was to mislead us and to stonewall us. Now, the Republicans in that case, quite apart from other witnesses, again, expressed great umbrage. How dare you come in here? And to claim executive privilege, which he was then doing, in such a broad way is unsustainable and blah, blah, blah. We're going to have to insist. We're going to have to initiate contempt proceedings. We can't stand for this. Well, that was over a month ago, and it's been radio silence since. Now, why did the Republicans never follow up? Mm-hmm. Two reasons why they didn't follow up. The first is they soon realized after they did that, they couldn't defend their treatment of other witnesses like Hope Hicks and Corey Lewandowski and others who similarly came in and stonewalled on key questions. So that was a big problem. But the second reason is they didn't really want to know the answers. They wanted to, I suppose, punish Steve Bannon, but they didn't want to know the answers. And that's the more fundamental problem with how they conducted the investigation.
So I know we're going to run out of time, but what will you do differently if you're the chairman? Will you, first of all, will you just restart the investigation where it is right now? Would you release all these documents?
First of all, I think the Republicans did a real disservice in not bringing in the witnesses that we've been asking them for months to bring in. We could have moved this investigation much more expeditiously if they had done that. What we will do if we take over the majority is we will look at the work that's been done, the work that's been done by the Senate, the work that's been done by Bob Mueller, and decide, did they do all the work? Did they finish the investigation? Or are there parts of the investigation that were still left undone? So we'll reserve judgment. One of the issues that really concerns me, and it may go or may not to the reports of Mueller subpoenaing the Trump Organization, is we were never allowed to investigate money laundering.
Right. So you talked about this in your report, Deutsche Bank and the like. You wanted to go there, and the majority said no.
Yes, that's exactly right. And the reason why this is so significant, when we began the investigation, the allegations that the Trump campaign had secret meetings with the Russians were nothing more than allegations. The allegations of money laundering were allegations. Some of the allegations we were allowed to investigate, and we found actually, okay, this turned out to be very true. There were all these secret meetings with the Russians. We were never allowed to investigate whether the Russians are holding financial leverage over the president. That's a vulnerability for our country. That could influence what the president's position is on sanctions over Ukraine or sanctions over election interference or why he seemingly is incapable of criticizing Vladimir Putin. Do they have a financial hammer over his head? It's derelict for us not to find out. And we could find out, I think, in fairly short order. And the first place to stop would be Deutsche Bank. So I hope that Bob Mueller has the license to do that. It's within the scope of his investigation. But we didn't have the chance, and neither does the Senate. The Senate is not authorized either to look at this. And someone in the public interest needs to find out whether the Russians are holding financial leverage over our president.
So on Sunday, there will be an election. I'm putting quotes around it in Russia. And Vladimir Putin, of course, is expected to win another six-year term in office. He's already the longest-serving Russian leader since Stalin. A lot of people here in the U.S., even liberals, are worried that our sort of Russiagate obsession has both sort of overshadowed and distorted the real challenge of what Putin is actually doing in the world, that a sort of, you know, is this a modern day Red Scare that we're having? And, you know, have we become obsessed with 2016 at the expense of looking forward? You've been a leading proponent out there publicly all the time saying this Russia investigation is serious and it has to be taken seriously. Do you worry about that at all, that we've sort of made Vladimir Putin a 10-foot tall figure in our own politics?
I don't worry that we have overstated the danger by Putin and Russia. What I do worry about, and this is something and I'm glad you asked this question, that I always try to emphasize in talking about the Russian investigation and why people should care about it, is what the Russians did here, they've been doing all over the world. It was only new to us. And what we see going on around the world is a real rise of authoritarianism. We see autocrats on the rise in Hungary, in Poland, in the Philippines, in Turkey. We see the rise of far-right parties in Germany and Austria and France. This is part of a global challenge to the very idea of democracy. America needs to push back and fight back and be the champion of democracy and a free press and a free society. And right now we are not, at least not in the White House.
So you don't think those sanctions this week were a sufficient response to the Russian attack in the United Kingdom?
Not at all. I think the message they sent to Vladimir Putin was, this administration is going to do the absolute minimum. Many of the people on that list to be sanctioned were people that had already been sanctioned by Barack Obama. This from the president who says he's so much tougher than Barack Obama. The other people on the list, with only two exceptions, were people that Bob Mueller named, that this administration made no effort to identify. That was Bob Mueller's work. We're not likely to get those people here, and the economic impact of that very limited set of sanctions isn't going to make much difference to the Russians. So I think they were really seriously inadequate and sent exactly the wrong message.
In the Intelligence Committee, there was an announcement, public announcement the other day, that even more cyber attacks from Russia had occurred, including on our power infrastructure, our nuclear power infrastructure. This started at the same time, really, as this election intervention in 2015. I thought that was like a wow story. Are you aware, in a broad sense, that there are more things yet to become public about the components of this Russian campaign inside the United States, which seem to have all ramped up after the 2014 intervention in Crimea?
Yeah, there is certainly a lot that I can't discuss that I would characterize as a broad-ranging threat from Russia.
So it's not just internet trolls?
It's not just internet trolls. There is a broad ideological fight globally over the idea of democracy that the Russians are trying to tear down. There are cyber attacks and infiltrations by the Russians into all kinds of systems.
Including things that are not public.
Yes. There are military threats posed by the Russians and treaty violations by the Russians. There are obviously poisonings by the Russians around the world on foreign soil, political assassinations. Of course, the Russians invaded their neighbor. They propped up a regime that was gassing its own people in Syria. These are bad actors, and they're not our friend. They're not going to be our friend simply because the president says nice things about Putin or refrains from saying bad things about Putin. And we're going to need to stand up to them because the only thing the Russians respect is strength. They don't see that in this president. They see weakness. And they also see in this president someone they can manipulate just by saying flattering things. And that's a real danger to this country, and it's a danger to our allies, and we need to step up to this challenge.
But you don't worry that Putin's, we're also playing into his hands, though, if he needed a war on the West in order to justify the legitimacy of his own election. We've sort of handed him that, right?
Putin has viewed his ticket to the grand stage and Russia's resurrection as coming at the expense of the United States. We can wish it were otherwise. That was true before Donald Trump arrived on the scene. It will be true after Donald Trump leaves the scene. That's just a reality of who this former KGB operative that's become the president of Russia. So we have to deal with it. I don't think it plays into his hands. It's just a reality. I don't think we should make him 10 feet tall. And I think this poisoning in London was a tragic miscalculation on Putin's part. But we need to recognize that Russia at the present is a malevolent force that needs to be pushed back.
So Donald Trump has called you Little Adam Schiff. Do you have a nickname for him? And do you think right now, are you ready to say he should be impeached?
I don't have a nickname for him. You know, the first impulse, and I've been the subject of now many nicknames from the president, is, you know, it's so absurd that you want to laugh. And then it's such a diminishment of the Oval Office, it makes you want to cry.
Last week's guest on the show was Chuck Todd, who was called a sleepy-eyed son of a bitch by the president.
Yes. Well, you know, these are the kind of grade school insults that you see lobbed from the White House. So, you know, we don't want to get down in the sandbox with him. I think, frankly, the best way to respond to his Twitter insults is with humor and mockery. He makes himself a very easy target of being mocked. And so when he tweets at me early in the morning from watching Fox and getting all upset in his bathrobe, we point out that clearly he's had a busy morning of executive time. I think that's the best way to respond. With this president, I think you need to push back hard, but you don't need to push back dirty. You don't need to get down to his level.
Impeachment?
You know, I don't favor people talking about impeachment. I tried an impeachment case in the Senate some years ago involving a corrupt federal judge. And, you know, there's a legal standard and what constitutes a high crime and misdemeanor, but there's a political standard too. And I think the political standard is if we give the country the impression this is something we're eager to embrace even before the investigation is done. Now, the House may say their investigation is done, but the investigation isn't done by any means. If we give the country that impression, then if the evidence does warrant it, it's going to be a much harder case to make. So let's finish our investigative work. We're going to continue as Democrats on the committee to do our investigative work. We're still learning more from the intelligence community. We still have witnesses who are willing to come in and talk with us, even if the Republicans aren't interested in listening. So we're going to continue to do our work. And Bob Mueller's going to continue to do his, and the Senate will do theirs. And when we're done, then we can decide, does that rise to the level of removal from office?
So that's Congressman Adam Schiff, who is our guest, our only repeat guest so far on the Global Politico, coming full circle after the beginning of the House Intelligence Committee investigation and now back to the end. One final question. You've impressed many of your fellow Democrats in your very public and vocal communicating with people about this investigation. You're now even talked about as a potential successor to Nancy Pelosi, should the Democrats win the House. Would you consider running for Speaker?
Well, I'm for Nancy. I think she's the most talented person we have in the caucus, and I don't think there's even a close second. So my hope is that she stays and is our Speaker if we take back the majority. What people don't realize, I think, is a couple of things. First, whoever has that job in the post-Newt Gingrich era is going to be shredded, going to be torn apart. And you won't recognize them after a certain period of time. And the second thing is, we're a very difficult caucus to keep together. We're a very diverse caucus. Unlike the Republican conference, we are very diverse. And you really need someone with a kind of skill set that she has to keep us together, and she does an extraordinary job of it.
So that was sort of a non-denial denial.
Well, you know, I hope she stays. I hope she becomes our speaker.
But you would not rule out seeking to follow her.
Well, I honestly don't know what my future holds, in the sense that I had thought about running for the Senate if Senator Feinstein retired, and I told the senator I was full support of hers. I hope she would run again. If she did, I would support her. And she has run again and is running again. So I hadn't thought about much other than that and haven't had much time to think about much other than what I'm doing in the day job. Right now, what I am doing is traveling around the country trying to help take back the House. And so when I'm not working on my day job, that's my night job.
All right. Well, stay tuned, folks. Sounds like there might be an interesting decision in your future. Congressman Adam Schiff, thank you so much for joining us on the Global Politico. And, of course, thank you to our audience. As always, the best audience on podcasts. And you can email me or write anytime at sglasser@politico.com. And you can listen to us on Apple Podcasts. Thank you.
Thank you.